Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Story is the podcast helping you make sense of the news. Join me, Katya Adler, every weekday as I take a closer look at the stories making the headlines with insights from the BBC's global network of experts. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and we're recording this edition at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 28th of November. Rescuers in northern India begin an operation to pull 41 construction workers out of a collapsed tunnel through a narrow pipe. The truce in Gaza appears to be holding for a fifth day after a swap deal between Israel and Hamas was extended.
I was talking about this obligation that we have to get as many people out as possible. If that includes a pause, not a ceasefire, a pause for a number of days, then so be it.
And the first long-haul flight powered by alternative fuel has taken off from London. Also in the podcast...
Beyond our wildest dreams, it's an incredibly beautiful rock. It's very, very black, but with some tiny little white bits in as well.
Scientists get their hands on a sample from the Bennu asteroid. After 17 days trapped underground, 41 construction workers in northern India are expected to reach the open air in the coming hours. The day labourers had been helping to build a road tunnel in the foothills of the Himalayas when part of it collapsed. After numerous setbacks, rescuers finally broke through on Tuesday afternoon. Specialist miners dug the last few metres by hand when drilling equipment broke. This was the scene at the tunnel entrance as families and rescue workers waited for the men to be pulled out. The authorities have not said what caused the landslide, but there's been criticism of the $1.5 billion Char Dham Road project, which is backed by the Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The tunnel didn't have an emergency exit and was built through a geological fault, according to a disaster investigator quoted by Reuters news agency. Just before we recorded this podcast, I got the latest from our correspondent Anant Zanani at the tunnel entrance.
There is a lot of presence of just ordinary people as well, not just personnel who've been, you know, doing various kinds of works here to bring these workers out. But it's just ordinary people who live in villages nearby who are here, who are also, in a sense, hoping for that good news that everyone is talking about for the last couple of hours, that breakthrough of both ends of the pipeline that they were laying down has been achieved. And it's perhaps just a matter of time that these people will be brought out. It could take about 3 to 4 minutes to bring one worker out. So that's roughly adds up to about 3 to 4 hours. But that hasn't really sort of dampened the mood here. People are here. The families of those workers who are trapped inside are here. They're waiting next to ambulances. There are about 15 to 20 ambulances that I can see from where I'm standing. Once these workers come out, be loaded with those workers and their family members, and they'll make their way to a hospital nearby.
Yeah, just take us through how they're going to do that. So for weeks they've been trying to get through to the men. They now have made it, and they've managed to put this 90 centimetre wide pipe into the tunnel. How are they going to get the men out?
This entire operation now is going to be taken care of by the NDRF, which is the National Defence Rescue Force. They're the ones who are going to lead this operation now. So what essentially they're going to do is, once you know, these workers have reached the other end of the tunnel, the NDRF workers, they'll start sending one worker on a stretcher, and that's a stretcher that also has wheels to it, so it's easy to drag it using a rope. And they'll be pulled out of this pipeline, this 57-58 meter long pipeline, and brought out to safety. Paramedics and doctors inside who'll quickly check them for any kinds of symptoms. Then they'll also meet with the chief minister of the state where all of this is happening, and then they'll be brought out into these vans, and they'll be loaded, and they'll be taken to that medical facilities. That's roughly how it's going to unfold once all these 41 workers are brought out safely using that pipeline through wheeled stretchers.
There will no doubt be joy at what seems to be a happy ending to this incident, but are there questions for the Indian authorities over building in this area, which was known to be prone to landslides?
Absolutely. And the government was asked this question a couple of days ago And they said that there's a committee that's looking into all of this now. But, you know, they said we'll park that for later. But right now, the focus is entirely on this rescue operation. Even the workers and their families are saying, why did this really happen in the first place? If this was such a tough terrain, the geology of this entire landscape was questionable. If there was loose, area between the point from where the landslide happened, why was no effort made to strengthen it? Why were workers working beyond that point in the tunnel? So these are many unanswered questions. And also there's this whole idea about having an escape tunnel, which was not there. So when you're building a tunnel, you ideally supposed to have an escape tunnel. So in case of an event like this, a landslide event like this, when the roof of the tunnel collapses, you can come out through escape routes. Where were those escape routes? These are many unanswered questions that will really hound the authorities and also this company that was making this tunnel.
Anant Zanani at the tunnel entrance in northern India. By the end of tomorrow, if all goes according to plan, more than a third of the hostages abducted by Palestinian gunmen last month will have been freed. Despite reports of gunfire in Gaza today, 20 more Israeli women and children are due to be released over the next 48 hours after the swap deal with Hamas was extended. Mediators are pushing for a further extension, but negotiations over the remaining captives, some of whom are soldiers, are likely to be tougher, while Israel is keen to restart its military offensive as soon as possible, as Wira Davis now reports.
This is the plaza in central Tel Aviv that's become the focal point for the friends and families of those who were abducted, kidnapped by Hamas and have been in Gaza ever since October the 7th. The names and the faces of the men, women and children are everywhere. And in the last 4 days, it's become often a scene of joy as the names of the women and children who've been released have been made public. But there's always been this sense of trepidation that those 4 days of relative calm would come to an end, and of course many people would still remain hostages in Gaza itself. So the news that that truce has been extended by at least another couple of days has been universally welcomed here.
A very good friend of mine who was doing security at the party, Shlomi Ziv, has now been taken hostage into the Gaza Strip. And unfortunately, he's a male and he's 40 years old. He's not going to be part of this pause for the next couple of days.
And would you be prepared to delay the military action that is inevitable until as many people are out as possible?
Yeah, absolutely. I was talking about this obligation that we have to get as many people out as possible. If that includes a pause, not a ceasefire, a pause for a number of days, then so be it.
This is the first priority in our country, that everyone will be home, no matter what the price.
A 2-day extension will not be straightforward. Not all of the hostages are thought to be held in the same parts of Gaza, and some of them were probably abducted by groups other than Hamas, says the BBC's Gaza correspondent Rushdie Abu Alouf, now working out of Istanbul.
Not only Hamas, but the Palestinian Islamic Jihad also went in and they announced that they have 30, some smaller group. They were holding some of the hostages. Some of the hostages were taken by just ordinary people, by families, because many families, they went inside, thousands of people, since the fence was cut.
Miri Eisen is a retired colonel in the Israeli Defense Forces and is an expert on security issues. She says the extended truce will be temporary and Israel's military priority to crush Hamas will not waver, whatever the external pressures.
Israel has said hostages and dismantling Hamas. It doesn't contradict. Only the military action brought the Hamas to a real negotiation table. You need the diplomacy to bring the people home. But the only reason they came in the first place is because of the ground military option, not the aerial one, and certainly not just the diplomacy.
Joyous celebrations in the West Bank city of Ramallah have welcomed the dozens of Palestinians freed as part of the deal between Hamas and Israel. 33 Palestinians, including 30 teenagers, were released from Israeli prisons yesterday alone. Noor Odeh, a political analyst and former spokesperson for the Palestinian Authority, says Hamas may be eventually defeated militarily by Israel in Gaza, but it has shown it must be part of any discussions about a future Palestinian state.
Palestinian leaders should be acceptable to the Palestinians, not to their occupiers. And I think the thinking that Palestinians can simply overlook Hamas or pretend that it doesn't exist is disastrous. And it's really more about giving ordinary Palestinians their voice back, their right to choose who leads them and in what direction.
An Israeli mother cries with joy, seeing her child's name on a list of those to be released from Gaza. The past few days have brought moments of relief, joy and anguish on both sides. Conflicting emotions in turbulent times for Israelis and Palestinians.
Wira Davis in Tel Aviv. Well, as part of the original deal, Israel freed a total of 150 Palestinian teenage boys and women, including Itaf Jaradat.
The price of our freedom is expensive. We always hoped that we would be freed and that our people would be safe and happy. But this is our destiny. We were freed, but they are in a sea of blood. We hope God grants victory to the resistance and that Gaza returns better than it was before.
But since the Hamas massacre of the 7th of October, the number of Palestinians in Israeli detention is reported to have shot up to around 8,000, many of them held without charge. As we heard, our Gaza correspondent Rushdi Abu Alouf is now covering the conflict from Istanbul. I asked him what he'd been hearing about possible clashes in Gaza.
There is only one person injured, according to medical sources. He was shot in his leg. The Hamas run health ministry said he was trying to returned to his house and shot a refugee camp. It's the beach, the only refugee camp in Gaza. They said he was shot in his leg. But this morning, there was an exchange of fire and about three explosions around this area. It's located in the northwest of Gaza, where you can still see some smoke rising out of a building that was hit by an Israeli tank shell, according to a local journalist who I managed to spoke to. The communication is extremely difficult in the ground, especially in Gaza City and the north, where the Israelis are focusing its ground operation. The Qataris, the Egyptians who are mediating the ceasefire are aware of this, and they said this is not a very serious development, and they are talking to Hamas and the Israelis to try to contain the situation and allow the ceasefire to take place and the aid convoy to arrive into Gaza. We understand that up to 100 trucks were allowed this morning and more will be allowed later on today, mainly carrying food, water and medical supplies. But what people need, they have been calling in social media when the internet was resumed in the south, that they need shelters and they need clothes proper for the winter, because it was very windy this morning and it was heavily raining around the places where about a million Palestinians are displaced from their homes in Gaza City and the north. And now they are taking the southern part of Gaza's shelter, especially in Khan Yunis, where many UN schools have been turned into shelters. There is no proper tent to protect the people from the rain and the wind.
The BBC's Gaza correspondent Rushdi Abu Alouf talking to us from Istanbul. A flight has taken off from London bound for New York that some hope could help the aviation industry reduce its carbon emissions. It is the first transatlantic flight powered by alternative fuel, but environmental groups labelled it greenwashing. Kate Hewitt, policy director at the Aviation Environment Federation, says this flight will not make much difference.
Sadly, it's more of a gimmick than a game changer, this. A single flight operating on 100% alternative fuel isn't going to change the fact that, as we've heard, 99.9% of aviation fuel is still kerosene. And these kind of waste-based fuels aren't going to be possible to scale up to really change that situation.
I spoke to our international business correspondent, Theo Leggett, and asked him first what this alternative fuel is made of.
Well, what they're using is something called sustainable aviation fuel. Now, that's fuel that's chemically pretty much identical to kerosene, which is jet fuel as you and I would know it. The difference being it doesn't come from crude oil. It's made, in this case, largely from waste fats and also from some farm residues of corn farming. Sustainable fuels are being seen as a vital component in the greening of aviation because the industry has a problem. It's growing very rapidly and it wants to keep growing very rapidly. But when it comes to reducing its carbon output, it's very, very difficult. For short-haul flights, there are options on the table. So, for example, electric and hybrid planes or planes powered by hydrogen, those conceivably can work in the future over shorter distances. But when it comes to flying across the Atlantic, batteries aren't really an option because they're too heavy for the amount of energy they produce. Whereas hydrogen, it does produce a lot of energy, but it's difficult to store. It's very, very bulky. So to cross the Atlantic, your plane would need to be absolutely full of hydrogen, even if it's cooled and liquefied. So in order to get to a sort of lower carbon environment, sustainable fuels are being seen as the main way to go, at least in the short term. The problem is making these fuels isn't particularly easy. It's expensive at the moment. The feedstocks, so the waste fuels, the agricultural residues, the forestry residues, they're limited. There is an alternative which in which you can make it from waste carbon dioxide and hydrogen, but then you need a good supply of hydrogen, and we simply aren't able to do that at the moment. This is kind of a longer-term thing. The industry needs to ramp up. There needs to be a much bigger supply of sustainable fuels in order for it to become viable, and the costs really need to come down as well.
Theo Leggett, our international business correspondent. Now, it was one of the biggest science stories of the year. In September, NASA successfully brought back rock samples from an asteroid called Bennu. Now, after a journey of more than 6 billion kilometres through space and a dramatic landing in the Utah desert, a sample has arrived in the UK. Here's our science editor, Rebecca Morell.
At the Natural History Museum in London, scientists have been waiting for years to get their gloved hands on these jet-black specks of asteroid dust. The material comes from a 500-metre-wide space rock called Bennu and was collected by a NASA spacecraft and brought back to Earth in September. About a teaspoonful of the sample has now been shared with the museum and some universities in the UK. And while this might not sound like much, every single grain of the asteroid will be carefully analysed. Professor Sarah Russell is a planetary scientist at the Natural History Museum.
It's beyond our wildest dreams. It's an incredibly beautiful rock. It's very, very black, but with some tiny little white bits in as well. And we found that each little grain looks a bit different to the other grains. So it's going to keep us busy for years trying to figure it all out.
Scientists are particularly interested in studying water and carbon within the rock. One idea is that an asteroid like Bennu crashed into the Earth early in its history, delivering the organic molecules that made life here possible.
Rebecca Morell. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
It mimics the kind of perfect conditions of a cellar, but more extreme. And the pressure is said to just be a kind of a different style.
A new way of storing wine inspired by a 19th century shipwreck. The wife of the head of Ukrainian military intelligence, Mariana Budanova, is being treated in hospital for the effects of poisoning. Unnamed officials suspect it was an attempt to assassinate her. Here's our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
Ukraine has not publicly given details of Mariana Budanova's condition, nor of what she's said to have ingested. Ukrainian media reports citing intelligence sources say she's believed to have eaten contaminated food and that she's completed an initial course of treatment. One report says her husband, Kirilo Budanov, is unaffected. But officials believe he's been targeted previously in assassination plots. General Budanov said in an interview earlier this year that he lives with his wife in the office. He's on an official wanted list in Russia. The service he leads has been linked to sabotage attacks, including drone strikes, in occupied Ukraine and Russia itself.
Danny Eberhardt. A long-running disagreement between Britain and Greece over the Parthenon sculptures, or Elgin marbles, has erupted into a diplomatic row. The sculptures are housed in the British Museum after being brought here in the 19th century, and Greece wants them back. But the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has cancelled a meeting with his Greek counterpart after the visiting Kyriakos Mitsotakis made these comments on BBC TV on Sunday.
This is not, in my mind, an ownership question. This is a reunification argument. Where can you best appreciate what is essentially one monument? I mean, it's as if I told you that you would cut the Mona Lisa in half, and you would have half of it at the Louvre and half of it at the British Museum. Do you think your viewers would appreciate the beauty of the painting in such a way? Well, this is exactly what happened with the Parthenon sculptures.
The British government said it believed it had assurances that the Greek Prime Minister wouldn't speak out while on his UK visit, but a Greek source has denied this. The debate has become more heated recently after some museums and governments around the world began returning artefacts to their countries of origin. I got the latest on the row from the Global News podcast's Peter Goffin.
We've seen a statement from the British Museum which says it's in discussions with Greece about a long-term partnership around the Parthenon sculptures so that they can be shared with audiences around the world while still, in the museum's words, maintaining the integrity of the British Museum's collection. The museum has also said that under current British law, it cannot unilaterally decide to send artifacts permanently back to their countries of origin, though they can be loaned out. But this issue goes far beyond the so-called Elgin marbles. So, Ollie, I would like to take you on a little tour of the British Museum.
Mm-hmm.
We'll start with another headliner artifact, the Rosetta Stone. This is the giant tablet that helped modern scholars understand ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. It was uncovered by Napoleon's occupying armies, then taken by Britain as a spoil of war. Last year, thousands of Egyptians signed petitions demanding it back and calling the stone's presence in the British Museum a symbol of Western cultural violence. Now, speaking of stone, the British Museum also has two Moai statues. You may know them better as the Easter Island heads. They were taken from Polynesia by the British Navy in the 1800s and given as a gift to Queen Victoria. Well, now the descendants of the indigenous people who carved those statues have said they represent the spirits of their ancestors, and Chile, which owns Easter Island, has tried to negotiate their return, so far without success. And before we leave the museum, Ollie, I want to show you to the Benin bronzes, these elaborate carvings from what is now Nigeria. They decorated the royal palaces of the Edo people and were used in rituals. They were looted by British colonial forces near the end of the 1800s as part of a brutal crackdown on Benin's leaders. Some were sold on to Germany, many of them still in the British Museum, a strong point of contention between Britain and Nigeria.
Yeah, you mentioned Germany. Some Benin bronzes have been returned by Germany, so I guess more pressure on the UK to do the same.
That's right. France returned some Benin artifacts as well. That was part of a commitment made by the French president, Emmanuel Macron, to return as many artifacts looted from their historical colonies in Africa as possible. He told Burkina Faso in 2017 that African heritage can't just be in European private collections and museums. Now, Germany, as you mentioned, has taken similar steps. Belgium has recently presented the Democratic Republic of Congo with an inventory list of Congolese cultural artifacts that it still has. And in North America, there's been a growing movement of major museums returning the remains of indigenous people, which have been in their collections as treated basically as specimens for decades.
Peter Goffin. The winner of the BBC Women's Footballer of the Year has been announced. It's England and Manchester United's Mary Earps. She's the first goalkeeper to win the award. Maz Faruqi from BBC Sport went to Manchester United's training ground to surprise her.
Everyone, this is for Mary, so shh, should we all hide?
We've never said this to a goalkeeper before, on behalf of the BBC World Service, you are the BBC Women's Footballer of the Year 2023.
Super special. Thank you very much to everyone who voted for me. Yeah, very, very humbled and really glad that I can be the first goalkeeper to win it. Special.
Mary Earp sounding a little embarrassed at all the attention, but Maz told me more about her reaction.
Yes, she was delighted, I think, to win this award because it's a special award, this BBC Women's Football of the Year award. It's voted for by the public. And so for her, that's something that means an awful lot. She talks an awful lot about in her career the fact that the goalkeeping position, particularly in women's football, isn't one perhaps that is always talked about in the same way as, say, midfielders or forwards. So the fact that a goalkeeper has been able to win this award, she feels is a personal, very special moment for her. And of course, she's had a really, really impressive and consistent 12 months, both for England and for Manchester United. And she's becoming a real role model as well, off the pitch as well, which is, again, something that's very, very important to her.
Yeah, I mean, just remind us about her performance for England in the World Cup.
Well, of course, they just fell short in the World Cup final, but she did save a penalty from Jenny Hermoso in that final back in August in Sydney. England, though, just losing out to Spain in that World Cup final. But they'd suffered so many injuries heading into that tournament. For them to even get that far really was really impressive. She was also awarded FIFA Best Goalkeeper of the Year, Golden Glove as well at the World Cup for her performances between the sticks. She really is one of the most consistent performers in the global game, men's or women's football, in her position, which is obviously something that she's very proud of and is reflected in her, you know, winning this award today.
Yeah, fans also love her, but they were, of course, unhappy they couldn't get her shirt.
Yeah, this is one of the big things that we talked about as well. Ahead of England playing in that World Cup in New Zealand and Australia earlier this year, shirts, England shirts, were on sale through their sponsor, Nike, but Mary's goalkeeping jersey was not one of those that was initially available. And this was a conversation then that she went back to the England sponsors to ask them to reconsider that decision. Petitions were made as well from fans because they all wanted to be able to wear the shirt of their favourite player, their goalkeeper, Mary Earps. And eventually Nike did decide to release that shirt in limited numbers and it was a sellout. So it just shows that, you know, there is the market there for people to want to buy goalkeeping jerseys. And she says with her performances and everything that she's achieved over the last 12 months, for her, what's really important is she wants young girls and boys to want to play in goal, to want to be the next goalkeeper, the next Mary Earps. She really is inspiring the next generation in that way.
Now, you said fans voted for the award and a couple of international stars also did well.
Yes, other players involved in this award, of course. We had some other brilliant players. Ballon d'Or winner and Antoine Bonmatí as well was one of the real big names up for the award this year. It's been a fantastic 12 months for the game. And of course, we've got the Olympics as well, the football tournament there to look forward to next year in women's football.
Maz Faruqi. Finally, to a new way of storing wine inspired by a 160-year-old shipwreck. Veuve Clicquot has been experimenting with aging its champagne underwater. Some of its bottles and those from another French winemaker were found at the bottom of the Baltic Sea and have been described by experts as tasting incredible. Wine writer Alicia Hansel spoke to the BBC's Will Bain.
There is already a winery in Croatia. There's a few people doing experimenting with things in Argentina, in the Baltic Sea. So, and actually in England, they will, you know, put it in a secure kind of crate, as it were, and then submerge it. The one in England, it was 60 metres under the sea. And they came to that figure because for every 1 metre you go down, it is increases by a certain percent of pressure. Right. But essentially the idea around it is that...
So is that the science, right? That the pressure, yes, makes a difference?
Well, there's a few things. So first of all, it's because it mimics the kind of perfect conditions of a cellar, but more extreme. So it's a constant temperature, it's cold, and more importantly, which people forget about, it's dark. Light actually really can affect wine bottles. That's why they're mostly in green glass, because it affects light strike. Then you've got the more interesting idea of pressure and of the constant rolling, gentle lapping of the sea.
Which, if anybody's been on a sort of champagne tour on holiday in France or whatever, you see them do, right, by hand, go along and twisting the bottles
riddling,
over and over
exactly.
again.
Exactly. I mean, at that point, the yeast would be in there. So then the wines that have been shipped that were found on the shipwreck would have been disgorged. And they are using disgorged wines, i.e. that leads as left. What's interesting about the pressure idea is that obviously there's corks in these bottles. And we don't want any water to come in and out, obviously. You do hear people saying, oh, there's a saline note. But I think that's more of a
urban myth.
Yeah, exactly. Because if there's water getting into it, then it's incorrect. However, cork does allow for micro-oxygenation. And that's what kind of changes and helps to evolve the flavours of a wine over time. So if you're thinking it's down and under pressure, it's got a different amount of oxygen, therefore it's a reduced amount of oxygen going into it. And the pressure is said to just be a kind of a different style, and it leads to kind of a bit more of a fresher note. Actually, they're a little bit younger than you would probably expect them to be.
Wine writer Alicia Hansel. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Vladimir Morzechka and produced by Tracy Gordon. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.